This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Jennifer Cation Armstrong returns to the show this week, and it's always a pleasure to have her here. I first met Jennifer here on From the Bookshelf in 2013, I think, when she published Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and All the Brilliant Minds Who Made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a Classic, a fantastic history of that sitcom masterpiece. And since then, Jennifer Cation Armstrong has written about Seinfeld, Sex in the City, Mean Girls, a dandy little book about pop divas, and a remarkable television history called When Women Invented Television, The Untold Story of the Female Powerhouses Who Pioneered the Way We Watch Today. I highly recommend them all. Her new book, also delightful, is called Parks and Rec, the underdog TV show that literally inspired a vision for a better America. If you've never watched Parks and Rec, I still recommend this book because Jennifer Cation Armstrong is on every page of it, and she's a treasure. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. That is very nice of you to say.
Well, as I was saying, you know, I've known you since you were a little girl in 2013. But I learned more about you than I ever knew when I read your new book, Parks and Rec. So why is there more of you in this book?
I mean, part of it is that actually my editor encouraged that when she had heard that I was a local newspaper reporter. And I also think that was right, because it explains like my personal connection to this, and that it's not just, you know, and I've had others, like in my Sex in the City book, I had an intro where I talked about canceling my wedding because of Sex in the City. But it turned out to be a good idea that people knew that it wasn't just like I'm a TV historian, which is true, but also that I had this background in local government, which most people don't have. Most people don't have a connection to it. And it's a big reason that I had a connection to Parks and Rec right away, even though, as we were talking about off the air and as my book talks about, it wasn't like at its best when it first came on. But I did think from the beginning that it was so remarkable that we got to have a show about local government, because it is really interesting, but it's, most people don't realize that.
Well, regular listeners to this show know, because I make you talk about it all the time, that when you were in your days at Entertainment Weekly, that you covered a television show called The Apprentice. And I want to know, to what degree did the fact that the host of that show is now wreaking havoc on the world inspire you to write about Parks and Rec? It seems like that's part of it, right?
Huge amount, actually, you know, I mean, and it's weird because it's both because that did have an effect on the show's trajectory, like that made it bigger, and also like my interest in it, if that makes sense. Both things were kind of coming together. I can actually even remember, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that, talking to someone about like, oh, could you do a Parks and Rec? And I was like, eh, no. But all of these forces sort of came together to make it much more interesting. And yeah, you know, I did, I literally even not only had the local newspaper and government experience, but also the experience of covering Donald J. Trump in his Apprentice days. And this show is very of the Obama era. It literally is nested inside of it. It's like it started in 09 and ended in 15. And as I keep saying, but it's true, it's like, and then it ended in literally like weeks later, Donald Trump comes down the escalator, you know, like it's right in there. And that could have made it too dated, but instead it ended up having this effect of like this little cocoon around it that then when transported to our times, it actually felt more relevant somehow. You know, when it started streaming, it became one of the top streamed shows, and it's, this was right after Trump's election, and then that was heightened by the pandemic. And so I think people are really looking for hope and optimism, and it also shows you know, it does, it's not a perfect government in that show either, but it shows people genuinely trying to work for the good of others. And all of this stuff together has actually made it into this sort of like paragon of like, look, it wasn't that long ago that this seemed possible. Could we get back there? And I will also add, just because this just happened to me again, like 5 minutes ago, people keep telling me now, which is so great because it's what I wanted, that they've been inspired to get involved in causes and like local politics and things like that because of reading this book. And that to me was the biggest, like that was what I wanted. So
it's good news. Well, yeah. I think it's also about the diminished power of television. I mean, television used to have this tremendous power because everybody was watching the same thing. Whereas now everybody is watching, but they're watching something different. Every time you talk to somebody, you know, they tell you, oh, are you watching this? And it's a series you've never heard of.
Yes.
And it's in season 7.
You know, and it is a huge star. Yeah. You know?
And they like, tell what? You, what? Really? Yeah. And they always say, well, it doesn't really get going until season 5, but you have to stick with it.
That's so true. All true.
I remember when we were watching The West Wing, when it was on originally, not in streaming or DVDs or whatever. And then George W. Bush got elected president, and the wind just like got taken out of the sails of that television series because it was so much of its time. And you're a historian of television. So part of this is also about the waning days of network television and its place in history.
Yeah, that was another thing that I found super interesting about this story. I mean, you know, I knew I wasn't, as you saw from the book, like it's the happiest cast you'll ever meet. So like I wasn't going to find any behind the scenes drama, but the drama really comes from the fact that they were struggling to stay on the air every single season. But in the end, I think also stayed on because of the struggles. I really believe that of what was going on in network television. So this is a hilariously encompassed this similarly. It's like a very specific time that we thought might last longer. But in fact, it's like TV, you know, network television is really worried about cable. Yeah. Cable's encouraging, like who's watching cable now, right? They were worried about cable and they were worried about the DVR. So TiVo and those recording devices. And so there was a lot of, you know, rushing around trying to figure out how to deal with all of this stuff when they did, and it's so weird because you can like see that we know the comet is coming to hit Earth, but they like don't at this time. It's like, don't worry about any of this. None of this is going to matter, right? They're running around trying to figure out how do we count audiences if they have DVRs and like all of this stuff. It's like, none of it's going to matter soon, babe. Don't worry about it. But this is this transitional period in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And that is a huge part of this show's, you know, like I said, both struggles. And I think ultimately the reason they got to stay on with kind of lower ratings was, you know, the one time that NBC kind of kicked them out of Thursday night and put on something else called Outsourced. They, you know, very quickly ended up pulling Outsourced and putting Parks and Rec back. And I think that's because, especially at that time, it became a bird in the hand situation. It was like, this might not be a huge audience, but we know how big the audience is. And they're pretty loyal at this point. So they would rather have something that they understood was going to get something going on for them. And it had critical acclaim and blah, 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 goodwill, et cetera. Yeah. And so I think it's also why it survived in a weird way is because everybody loved the cast. Everybody loved Mike Schur, the creator. This came out of kind of the auspices of The Office. So there was a lot of goodwill there too. And it just became better to be like, you know what? We'd rather just have this on with 30 Rock and Community and all that. And at least it's a strong lineup versus trying to make something new happen there. So it's a very interesting whole thing when we cared about, you know, overnight ratings and commercials and how much ads sold for, when it then goes on to, spoiler alert, become one of the most streamed, you know, shows of the streaming era. But that's why this story was so exciting to me in addition to its political implications.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that part of it I find fascinating. So, like, for instance, in the 1940s, when Bing Crosby was a star on the radio, he had 20 million listeners a week on his radio program. And the population of America was like half what it is now. And at Parks and Rec's height, it had 5 million viewers a week. And I guess that's... I mean, how many viewers a week do you think Ghosts has, or...
That I don't even know, which is hilarious. And also, I would say in general, 5 million now is pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, that's a pretty good, I'd say if you're in the 5 to 10, like, you're probably a hit. That's just the way the numbers have gone. And I mean, you and I once were here talking about Seinfeld, which had, you know, 40 million viewers.
Yeah. Or what about Mary Tyler Moore? How many millions watched that?
They were definitely way up. I can't remember specifically, but like if I had to just guess off the top of my head, I'm saying like in the 20 to 30.
Yeah,
like that was just because we had three channels and you just watched. Like it's such a different. I really love this stuff. I find it fascinating the way that like technology has such an effect on really what we're watching. Because if you think about, you know, any time between Mary Tyler Moore Show and Parks and Rec, when, you know, Seinfeld time especially, right? The joke is always like the single guy, Caroline in the City. Like these are shows that we all, if you were around then, you remember because you just sort of watched them because they were in between things like Friends and Seinfeld.
Right,
and
right.
They had enormous audiences and they'd be pulled off the air because they only got, you know, 20 million viewers. And it's just, but you didn't have to be that good if you were, especially if you were near a good show. So stuff like that is fascinating to me. And this is why there was panic then, because it's like easier than ever to switch over to cable with your remote control, easier than ever to just record a show and watch it later or not and skip the ads. And if ads are everything, you know, they just really didn't know what they were going to do. And guess what? They still haven't solved it over at network television. You know, it's everybody is just doing the best that they can. And it's all just very fascinating to me.
Me too. I mean, when I was a kid, because I'm a little older than you, we watched a lot of horrible TV because, you know, there was no choice. And you watched the commercials because there was no scanning and that we didn't have remote control. When my brother had a remote control, go turn it off. Go turn the channel to make me do it. But,
yes.
you know, we just watched Gilligan's Island or whatever, even though it was like terrible. You know, there were shows also like My Mother, the Car or Hank, you know, they were on in the primetime schedule and they didn't do well. And so they said, well, we won't have them back, but we still make 32 episodes of it.
Yeah. Cause why not? Like it wasn't that big a deal either way. I mean, it was a whole different, I think too about those times, the '60s were a real low batch of television. I have to say, I'm fascinated by that. But yeah, it just, you know, it didn't seem like this is why television got a bad reputation. I think, you know, this is vast wasteland and all of that. because it wasn't high art. They weren't wrong. Like this was not, it was a different business model. So it was just like, you're just trying to sell cereal or whatever. And sometimes it paid to just keep My Mother, the Car on for a little while longer. And then you wouldn't have things like some huge finale that wrapped it all up. You wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't have any of these artistic-ish flourishes that we now have. And certainly people would not be online, you know, dissecting it. That was part of it. It's just that like, you just watched it and let it kind of wash over you and then went about your business.
Yeah. Well, actually, they were opposed to having finales because then it would kill syndication. When the Fugitive wanted to have a finale, which they did,
right,
and it was highly watched, you know, they were worried because it would kill syndication, which it did. It didn't syndicate for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a fair point if you think about, I mean, I think about my own attitude towards certain shows that I loved. I don't rewatch a lot of deep drama, I noticed. I was thinking about this lately because, like, I love Mad Men, but I don't want to, like, go through it again. Some people love to do that. It doesn't work for me. Like, my rewatches tend to be, like, a Schitt's Creek or a Parks and Rec, where, like, you know, which is a little bit of an argument. I mean, Schitt's Creek had a great finale, but so that's not exactly it. But it's, like, once you have that drama wrapped up, it is less compelling. I did rewatch Sopranos once or twice. You know, but it's rare that you have, you know, because of that, because part of drama is like, what is the ending going to be? So once you get it, something like The Fugitive, you're like, okay, great, solved it. I'm not going to sit here and like watch them try to wonder who did it. Yeah, you know, now.
The more soap opera-y a show is, and by that I mean having continuity from episode to episode, the less interesting it is to watch it a second time.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's, I don't know, there's something, I just noticed this recently because somebody was asking me about like the shows I rewatch. And I realized like, yeah, I don't really go back to drama. I've done The West Wing before. I've done some West Wing. That can be sort of fun because it's more about like, how much did the ending mean, right? Like The West Wing, it's not about the ending. You're right. Not like, yeah. Oh, now I understand the meaning of the presidency or whatever. Like I forget what the ending is. It's just like, the more you want to swim in that world and nothing else, then the more rewatchable it gets.
We're chatting with Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and her new book is called Parks and Rec, the underdog TV show that literally inspired a vision for a better America. Is it easier to write a history of stuff that happened long time ago than it is to write about stuff that happened a short time ago when the people, I mean, who's more honest, the people who are dead or the people who are alive?
I mean, I have to say when I did When Women Invented Television, I really liked that everyone was dead. I'm not going to lie. It was like an actual thing I was trying to do. I love that book and I think it's a really good idea, but there was also an element of like, you know what? I'm just going to hang out with these people's archives. That's the key though. You have to have something, right?
Yeah.
And archives are, I could talk for an hour just about this and I won't, but you know, archives can be honest or not. Actually, I didn't realize that till I was doing that book. Differing degrees of honesty in archives. And I will just give a brief example and move on. But, Erna Phillips, the inventor of the soap opera, her archive was incredibly honest. She had an unpublished memoir in there that was like very honest, like where she talked about how she wished she hadn't adopted her children and things like that.
Wow.
And like, you know, cause she was a single mother and she didn't feel like she had served them well enough, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Gertrude Berg, master of her image, who, was kind of the inventor of the family sitcom, she left out whole parts of her life from her archive. And had quite a thorough archive, but there's stuff that she didn't want to talk about. And so it's not in there. You know, that isn't a whole solution, but it just was a little more like, you don't have to worry about upsetting people, you know, besides their family members, like it's just a lot different. And I did really enjoy archival research in general because you could really nerd out and be a detective. But this was really, I mean, this was one of my best experiences working on this book, which it's fairly recent. You do have to have some distance or else like you can't tell. As I said, that 10 years ago, I was like, I wouldn't do a book about Parks and Rec. And now I was like, of course I would. So you have to have a little perspective on like, are people going to still want to talk about this? Blah, blah, blah. What's its impact? But you know, everyone's alive. I don't think I encountered any, well, there was one writer who died, Harris Whittles. But other than that, like, you know, this is people who were working recently and still are working. And just in this case, they were so like, I keep saying this, but it just was like a spiritual experience to talk to these people about this. There's something special happened among these people on the set. I feel really lucky that I got to be a little part of it in getting to tell their story and talk to them about it. Most of them wanted to talk to me because they just liked reliving it. They told me that over and over again. And I don't think there was, in this case, it just was, I'm fairly convinced that this was a genuinely incredibly happy set. So I didn't get the feeling that there was like stuff going on that they weren't telling me about, you know, any of that stuff. I'm sure there's tiny corners of this where like someone was unhappy, but most of this is like, you know, it just was a really happy story to tell. And so for that reason, I really liked, you know, I did pick this because I was at a point where I thought, I really want to pick a show where it's a very happy place to live for the next few years. I just couldn't take anymore. Like, I think Veep's great, and I'm not saying I'd never do it, but like, it was sort of on my list. And then I was like, I don't think I don't have the heart for that right now. I'm sure they were happy. Like, I'm sure it's a great set. But you know, just living in that sort of very cynical world, I wanted to live in a optimistic, happy place for a little bit. And so I got my wish in that way.
I was thinking as I was reading your new book about Parks and Rec, Jennifer Gation Armstrong, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I think, is probably the first workplace ensemble TV comedy. I mean, they had the school comedies, you know, like Armis Brooks, and they had, you know, service comedies like Bilko or McHale's Navy or something. But I think this is, that was the first workplace show. And that's what Parks and Rec is as well.
Yes. Yes. And actually, I mean, even me talking about like a happy set, the only one I've done that came that close to this mood was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. A lot of them also talked about Mary and Grant Tinker, her husband, who is the producer, like setting a really good tone on that set as well. And yeah, there's, I mean, extreme similarities between the two shows, in my opinion. You know, and this became like, oddly, they set sort of a trope that's very satisfying and doesn't get old, which is the Mary and Lou dynamic. There's a very Mary and Lou dynamic.
Right, right.
On Parks.
Between Amy Poehler and the guy that wrote the introduction to your book.
Nick Offerman, yeah. Yeah, it's very, very similar. I mean, they do it on 30 Rock, too, which I think is funny because it's a contemporaneous show. And Tina Fey talked about the fact that she literally modeled the 30 Rock pilot on Mary.
Oh,
but this is very, you know, I think this is, I don't want to compare those two, but like, this is just definitely one of my favorite examples. And the best part about this that I've thought about a lot is that even the Mary Tyler Moore Show once tried, I mean, it's a funny episode, so I don't think they were serious about it, but like they even tried to send Mary and Lou on a date once. Parks never even goes near trying, you know, that temptation of like, it's clear that this is a like, if there is a central relationship on this show,
yeah,
it is between Leslie and Ron. And they never try anything romantic. And I super appreciate that.
Well, one of the shows that I really love now, current shows, is Hacks. I think Hacks is this a wonderful show about the relationship with these two women, one 30 and one 75. And Jen Statsky, who is the showrunner of that show, came out of Parks and Rec. I mean, she had written for Jimmy Fallon or something, right? And then she became a writer for sitcoms on this show, and now she does that show. And there's a certain similarity, I think, also in those shows.
I mean, workplace again, right? I mean, that's the thing. It is, it's certainly if I had to pick a favorite of those kinds of things, like, and maybe that's just my own life. Like, I don't have kids, so family sitcoms are fine, but they don't really do as much for me. Whereas like, particularly like single women in the workplace kind of always do it for me. We still have struggles as we learn on Hacks, right? And yeah, it is interesting because I don't watch Hacks and be like, oh my God, it's so much like Parks and Rec. But there really are, you know, certain kind of like relationships you can set up that are just inherently interesting. And I love that one because it is sort of unique among a lot of television, which is this, not just intergenerational, but like there's a couple generations between them. They're pretty far apart. Yeah. You know, she could be possibly her grandmother.
Yeah. You know? I know. And they're in their last season now. And I'm thinking, how will they, maybe those two, they'll get married. Maybe that's what happens. Maybe. You never know.
It could happen.
The pacing of Parks and Rec is very unique. And you've got all of these people. You know, I think Aubrey Plaza is just one of the great talents of all time. She's so funny. Mm. And yet she has, you know, maybe 4 minutes in each episode. You've got so many characters. And the pacing is really fast no scene is longer than, I don't know, they're just very short scenes. It's very funny, but I think that pacing is unique. Can you think of any other show that has that?
It's a little, it's like somewhere, it's like not as fast as 30 Rock, right? 30 Rock just strikes me as like this incredible, like rat-a-tat. I can't stop comparing those two, by the way, because I feel like they were on at the same time, the same night. Tina and Amy are best friends, et cetera. Yeah. It's just really easy to kind of, but it's interesting to compare it to its contemporaries. And The Office, I would say, is much slower. That's just, I haven't done any scientific study on that. But given that it's supposed to be kind of the little sister of The Office, it came right out of The Office. It's the next mockumentary. You know, this is after this mockumentaries kind of proliferate as a sitcom form. And I talk a lot in the book, because you may have been able to tell I nerded out a lot about this, is that they were always trying to like, yes, they came out of The Office, but then they were always trying to like differentiate themselves from The Office. And they would hit upon it as they went, which is one of my favorite things about TV, of especially olden times, right? Of these times when like they're doing it while it's while it's airing. It's not like they shoot a whole season and then put it out, which is what happens now and why everything is much slicker. This, they really kept like hitting on things that would make them different. And one of them is allowing improvs and then jump cuts to make their way into the final product. So on The Office, you might have them improv a lot, but you would pick one of those and use it because they were very dedicated to making it look like a real documentary. Like this is at one point going to air, you know? Right, right. And then at some point Parks just went like, know what? That's our documentary is not real. We're never going to acknowledge it. It is what it is. And so they started doing crazy stuff. And one of them was, if Amy does 12 improvs in a row and we like them all, they just like they put them together one by one, which I think is what gives it that energy. There is a like frenetic energy that maybe also matches like Amy's performance as Leslie to some extent. And then the wacky characters that they, and like you said, there's so much they have to do. It also makes me think of another nerdy concept that came up here, which is Greg Daniels, the co-creator who brought The Office over from England. He has a lot of nerdy concepts, and one of them is the killing field, which isn't as violent as it sounds. His idea was you have this huge cast, you know, full of improv geniuses. You put as many of them as possible in a room in a situation, and then let each of them like have a moment or two of reaction, and you're just going to get like comedy, 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 comedy. And I think you see this a fair amount when you have the gang together in Parks. I'm thinking of, you know, you noting Aubrey. It's like what you do is you introduce a situation and then each one of them has their like own sitcom character reaction to it. Chris Pratt's character is going to say something dumb and hilarious. You know, Aubrey's going to say something cynical and monotone, and like, you know, it's like that's what's fun about it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I don't like in drama or, you know, television series is when a character changes in a way that people don't actually change. Like, for instance, in Hacks, the character of the comedian,
Deborah Vance.
Yes, Deborah Vance. Thank you. She is awful, and she's never not awful. She doesn't like suddenly go, oh, I'll be sweet and I'll change my whole character and become it. She has things that happen to her and she grows, but she still is the same awful person all the way through.
Right.
And you know, like on soap operas, that happens all the time. Like a guy is like, we're not supposed to say retarded, but you know, so let's say the guy's retarded. Then, you know, after a couple of years, he's just talks slower, but he's no longer retarded. You know, like they just change that. And I don't like that because I think people don't do that. But in your book, you point out that they do sort of change the character of Amy Poehler from she's not good at anything to, oh, no, she's very competent. And that really made the show better when they came.
Yeah. It's an oddly subtle shift. It's weird because I don't think it, when I rewatch it, it's like, obviously I'm aware of it because I wrote about it, but They kind of, maybe they do it gradually. I'm not sure, but they did kind of like manage to, and it might help that it's maybe a little jump between seasons, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
But that first season, many people complained, probably accurately, that she was too much like Michael Scott from The Office. And somehow Steve Carell doing that worked, you know, being kind of out of it and incompetent, you know, I don't know if dumb is exactly right, but like, let's just go with like low emotional intelligence, right? Like he's pretty clueless and he does also grow into an empathetic character over time, but they kind of were a little too close with her character first, which was that she loves government and totally believes in it, but she's wrong. Right. She's clearly on the wrong side of things. Nothing's going to ever work. You know, she doesn't know how things work or how to do things. And it was, yeah, it was too much like Michael Scott. But I also think, I mean, it's possible that everybody's internalized misogyny. This doesn't read as well in a woman. Could be any number of those things. But in any case, they decided to kind of shift her and make it more like her and to some extent her friends slash staff and against the world, right? It becomes not that government doesn't work or that she's incompetent or stupid about it. It's that government is hard. They are all doing their best, especially her. She is doing her absolute best because she is on top of it and she loves government and she has binders and she knows what she's doing. And then it's just like this wacky world of characters who kind of constantly try to stop her. If you look at the town is very, you don't meet a lot of people you admire out there in the town. It's mostly kind of wacky people, which is not that unusual in local government, I have to say. Like part of what happens in local government is you attract the people who are on the extremes, right? I remember when I covered town meetings and it was like, oh, this woman's going to get up and talk about the egrets every time. We have to save the egrets. Like she's going to talk about that every time. you know, that's just what happened. You don't attract like most regular people, the reason they don't know about local government is because they're just trying to go about their day. They're not like, oh, did you know you get 3 minutes to say whatever you want at the city council meeting? It's only very special people who show up for that stuff. And so it is, or who show up to city hall to complain. I just did an event with a local mayor here in the Hudson Valley of New York. And he told a story, real story. And I was like, this could totally be Parks. About how a guy got upset that the city workers were trimming hedges close to his property line. He took their chainsaw from them, put it in his car, drove down to City Hall, and walked in with it and demanded an audience with the mayor. And then in the end, the guy was just like, please don't come near my bushes. And he was like, okay. But like, that's the kind of thing is like you get these sort of extreme situations. And that's completely the kind of thing that Leslie ends up dealing with. And we start to see her as almost a superhero in the way she can have the patience with these people, in the ways she figures out how to use the system to her best advantage. Not always, you know, she doesn't always win. But I think of when she filibusters, I think of what, you know, like she does these great heroic things and just does her absolute best to do her best by her constituents, no matter what they throw at her.
Well, above all, it's a comedy and it's really funny, but I find it inspiring to that degree because, you know, one of the things I find really depressing, Jay Leno used to do a thing where he would stop people on the street and prove how stupid they were. And,
yes.
And Jimmy Kimmel was doing it the other night where he was talking about King Charles's visit and he was making up all kinds of absurd things. What did you think when it turned out that Prince Charles had all those back tattoos? You know, and the people go, that was weird. You know, I mean, they just pointing out how stupid people are. And I don't find that funny. I find it really, really super depressing. So when I see a show that's funny, but it's also about people who are, you know, trying to do something, I like that.
I do too. And this was really why this hit me at this time. Cause I do believe, you know, all these, I believe that, you know, if something's going to save us, it's at the local level. I believe that good people are trying their best to do, you know, good in a lot of places and aren't just power hungry. And this is about community, right? This is about not just her, but the fact that she has her staff, and I keep saying staff / friends, but I think that's actually really important. She has her staff who are also her friends with her. I think you mentioned you're watching what season 4, is that her campaign?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the campaign stuff is tremendous and probably my favorite if I have to pick. Yeah. I keep showing it at my events. Probably my favorite scene is when she plans the rally. Her colleagues, really, who are now her campaign staff, plan the rally and they're not very good at it. And this is the one that ends up, it's in an ice rink. They didn't know an ice rink. Yeah. The carpet that she has to walk onto the stage is too short. The stage is too small. They couldn't get a full sign, so it's just her eyes. And there's this hilarious sequence where all of them together, there's like 8 of them plus the 3-legged dog, go out onto the ice together to get her onto the stage. And I keep pointing out about this, that they all decide to go together. They're like, we will not abandon Leslie because we screwed up this event. So they all have to like slide out on the ice together and fall down. It would actually be better if her whole campaign staff were not with her. Like, she could kind of get out on the ice, and even if she fell, it wouldn't be the same. And, you know, like, technically speaking, they probably should have just sat back there and let her do it. But there, to me, this is the whole show in one scene, is like, they were like, no, we go together, and it's going to be hilarious. And this is a scene where, actually, by the way, they play with this pacing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
The scene goes on way too long. Because they just let them like go out and fall on the ice repeatedly and try to get her up on the stage. And it just, the reason it's funny is because you're like, I can't believe this is still happening. And how, like, you know, how incredibly at that time, it's a little bit incompetent. And then in the most Leslie thing ever, instead of her getting up and pretending that it's going well, she gets up and she says, this is terrible, isn't it? And to me, that also indicates the character change. In season 1, Leslie would have pretended
that it was fine.
That had gone well. But this one is mature, and she's about to win the election against Paul Rudd. And she is like, look, I'm not going to kid you. Like, I know this is terrible. And she says something great, like, but I promise you there will be nothing but surprises if, you know, you support me. And that is the whole show. Like, that's where I think you know that they have, like, really nailed it, is in that scene.
Well, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, Parks and Rec kind of turns the whole idea of a guest star on its ear. I mean, they have a lot of famous people that show up in the show, and John Hamm, for instance.
Oh, well, John Hamm was a very special situation there, but yeah, it's true. I mean, even like Paul Rudd, you know, it's an indication of a couple of things. One is how much sort of pull these people had in Hollywood. Even this was not a huge hit, as we talked about. So they weren't coming on to like get their face in front of a lot of people. It was because they loved working with these people. And even like, you know, there's definitely Paul Rudd, who's a great example of this. I'm pretty sure he was already fairly famous by that point. He didn't need the money. He didn't need to do this, but he came on because he loved these people. He's actually, this is to me one of the cutest things ever. He's like longtime best friends with Adam Scott. So he knew like, this is going to be great. Catherine Hahn, who's a goddess, comes on that same season as his overpriced campaign manager, overpowerful campaign manager, Jen Barkley. Same thing. She knew these people. She loves them. Even if you think of Rob Lowe, who is, you know, a regular, not a main character, but that's like massive star power to have on the show
for only 4 minutes an episode or whatever he gets.
Yeah. And he absolutely loved being on the show, by the way. I was really taken with this. I thought, like, honestly, if he had said no to an interview request with me, I would have been like, fair, you know, like he's had like 17 lives in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And they're all huge, right? If you think, it's like, I don't even know what the first line of this man's obituary is, because there's like
too many things.
The heartthrob phase, there's the West Wing phase, there's, you know, so much. But he was happy to get on the phone with me and loved talking about this show. So I think that's very indicative. And then, yeah, they had, you know, that's such pull. This is the heights of, you know, Mad Men's just ending. And one of my favorite stories is they have this idea that when they do the, so they do a time jump between, you know, between the second to last season and the final season, the penultimate season and the final season. Yeah. And they had this idea that when they do the time jump, they just like, it's like, oh, we've gone 2 years later. We hone in on Leslie's office. And she's like in the middle of firing a guy because he did a bad job. And they were like, it'd be hilarious if we got someone famous. And the joke would be, oh, in that 2 year time jump, like you could have had 2 years of what turns out to be John Hamm on the show. Right. And John Hamm would fit in on the show. I just want to say like perfect because he is, he's like that secret funny guy. He's always like, he's such a great dramatic actor and so beautiful. And yet it seems like he always wants to prove himself with the SNL crowd.
Yeah.
He'd totally fit in, but instead it's like the scene of Leslie firing his character and he just walks out. And that's like, we get like 30 seconds of him. And that was a great story because they called him up and said, do you want to do this weird thing? And he was totally down with it. And he had to just kind of like not sign any paperwork and not tell his agent. And I know this doesn't sound like a hardship to most people, but drive himself over himself. He just drove onto the lot, like, you know, did the thing undercover and later filed the paperwork after it aired. Cause they were like, the minute anyone hears about this, it's going to be John Hamm is going to, you know, guest star on the final season and it's going to be a problem. And that also reminds me of the Bill Murray story from the final season as well. Kind of similar, you know, I don't think they meant it that way, but they wanted to have a funeral for the never seen mayor. And, they had been lobbying for years to get Bill Murray on the show as Mayor Gunderson, like literally going on talk shows and being like, please come on the show. We don't know how to reach you because you don't have an agent. Aubrey Plaza had met him and, you know, you can imagine Aubrey Plaza cornering you and trying to get you to trying to scare you into being on her show. And they finally like got a call from him one day. Mike Schur got a call from him saying, I hear you have some dead work for me because he was going to be just the mayor in the coffin. And they had really considered having such restraint that they would just have him as the mayor in the coffin and nothing else, which is kind of funny, but they couldn't resist. And ended up having a video that was like recorded by the mayor before he died. And that was Bill Murray. And they also had Werner Herzog in first or second, maybe back episode of the final season, just being really creepy and selling a creepy house to April Nandy and then walking off. And he later said, I have no idea what the show was. I did this show. I hope they use my part in it. No idea what he's doing, but. Showed up anyway.
Well, he was actually here at our radio station, KSQD, the other day.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's great. you just touched on something about how dramatic actors always want to do comedy and comedic actors always want to do drama. You know, Adam Sandler is like a big dramatic actor.
Yes. Now.
And I mean, I remember when Ed Wynn and Mickey Rooney and wanted to do, you know, drama.
Yes.
And John Wayne was on Laugh-In. You know, it's a, I guess you want to do the thing you can't do.
It's,
the thing
it's really true, but there's, it's actually weird because there's a number of people. I mean, I think most clearly it's like Rob and Adam, Rob Lowe and Adam Scott. I mean, Adam Scott, I think is a brilliant dramatic actor. He can really do both in my opinion. And he, I talked to him about this. I'm sure he's sick of people asking him. But I did anyway, because I couldn't help it. And he said he doesn't distinguish, which I think makes sense to me. You play the person the same way. Of course, you play them with the same intensity. You know, you just have to believe the person and everything else comes from that. And it comes from the writing and everything else going on around you, whether it's funny or not. I mean, because Severance can be funny at times too, while it is also very serious. And I think if you watch Parks, like I see this, I'm a huge, like I'm in the tank for Adam Scott. So forgive me. Huge professional crush on him. But, you know, I think you can see it in this show, too. He's a real grounding force. He's supposed to be. He's a little bit supposed to be the straight man. He's the one who always looks at the camera and is like, can you believe this? But I think you really see that in the way he does ground that, and the way also that's why his romance with Leslie Knope works, is both because he is a grounding force to her, like, yeah, kind of frenetic energy, and also because you're like, you really believe those two are in love. Like, I, every time I watch this thing through, I'm still like stressed out about whether Leslie and Ben are going to get together, even though I obviously know the answer.
Well, now I'm thinking about Mary Tyler Moore. So Mary Tyler Moore was hilariously funny on Dick Van Dyke and on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and then Ordinary People, not funny.
Yeah.
And even the spinoff, one of the many spinoffs of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Lou Grant, is a drama with the same the same character played by the same actor, but not funny.
Which I think you can especially see this in that. Think of how like intense his character is and how he is committed to it. It's just whether the people around, right, the people and situations around him are being funny or serious. He's always going to be Lou.
Yeah.
And he was a dramatic, right? He came
from everything, right?
Drama first, and was actually a little worried that he couldn't do the comedy of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. So maybe you just always have to have like some of those at least grounding forces. And I think of like Rob Lowe is different in the sense that he's also bringing his baggage, I think, in a good way,
yeah,
to that, to the Chris Traeger character,
where iconography, like, I guess you would say, right?
Part of the funniness is sort of like the times when he breaks out, right? Like, I think of when he like dances at April and Andy's wedding. I don't know if you've seen that, but he dances really crazy. Like there's just, and like when you start to see Chris Traeger, like he's kind of a dork. He's kind of a goofball, and there's something funny. I mean, just Rob Lowe's face alone makes that, you know what I mean? Like it's funny when someone that beautiful is funny. But also coming from the West Wing and bringing specifically, there's a connection, right, between West Wing and Parks. Like they literally pitched it as West Wing with lower stakes. And so to bring Rob Lowe in then, who was such an iconic character on West Wing, and then he has kind of this, right? I mean, I asked him at one point, do you think Chris was a fan of Sam Seaborn? And he's like, oh, he loves Sam Seaborn. He totally thinks he's Sam Seaborn. Obviously he's not. But that made it to me even funnier, because it's like, no, this guy kind of sees himself that way in the like beautiful lighting of West Wing, right? You know, looking out over Washington, D.C. But he's really just like a guy at, you know, taking his vitamins at Pawnee City Hall, which is funny.
Well, the thing I loved most about your book is I wasn't that familiar with the program, and yet I really enjoyed the book because you wrote it, but you're such a good writer. But it was really an interesting the story of a television show in the waning days of network television. And I want to ask you, you know, what else are you watching and listening to? What music are you listening to these days?
What music am I listening to? I mean, nothing too experimental or anything. I think I'm still into Sabrina Carpenter. Uh-huh. Still enjoying that ride, you know. I really, especially her and to some extent Chapel Roan, though she has not been, like I just was thinking about how Sabrina's just out there all the time.
Yeah.
Well, of course, and Sabrina, I really, I don't know, I appreciate like does, right? this sort of willingness to entertain me. I think that's the best way I can say it. Is like, I feel like we lost, like it was supposed to, you were supposed to like pretend that wasn't happening for a while. But she's very like trying to entertain me, and I really, that is something that I have really been enjoying about her. I mean, now she's doing stuff with Madonna, like it just does not stop. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And Madonna was like, yes, I will take one of those, thank you.
Her little duet with Paul Simon on the Saturday Night Live thing was great.
Well, that's the, she'll do, like that's what's kind of interesting about her too, is that she can do that, you know, she can do everything, and she seems to have incredible amounts of energy. She seems to be into doing that, and I think I mean, I just love it.
Do you have a take on this Michael Jackson movie? What do you think about that?
It is a horrible abomination and immoral. That is my soft chill take on it.
Is this coming from someone who has seen the movie or will never see the movie?
No, I will not. I will not. I don't think this is one where you need to. Sometimes you do need to see something to have a take on it.
Yeah.
Since I know about it, I understand, like, it's very well covered that this is, you know, only covering his rise.
Right.
And nothing else. And I just think, so I won't get into this too far, but I will just say, because a lot of people don't understand this. I actually went on a rant about this at my book party the other day. I was like, listen, you need to understand. This is an attempt by the family to launder his image so that they can increase streams. And in fact, that is already happening. I just saw it. Like, I just saw, like, if they're up 500,000,000% on Spotify or whatever.
Yeah.
So that they can sell the catalog for more money, because they were worried that, you know, people were not listening as much as they would if he were not a child molester, alleged. Right. And that is not okay to me. I mean, I don't even really like biopics. We've had this rash of music biopics for this reason, if people don't know. It's because estates want to up the sales figures for the catalog, ultimately. And, you know, it's one thing to say, like, oh, let's remind people about Bruce Springsteen's music with a subpar biopic. Sure, go ahead. I don't want to see it, but that's your problem. This, to me, is a new level of just, like, IP mining that things are not good. This does not look good. And then we're also, like, conveniently introducing a new Jackson to have his, you know, who plays his, you know, his nephew plays him.
Right.
That doesn't bother me as much as just the whole project. And this is, like, good. This is Antoine Fuqua. This is Coleman Domingo. This is good people. I get it. I was there during his initial rise. It was really fun, guys. Not going to lie. But as people have made many comparisons, and one of them is, like, this is like if you did a movie about Harvey Weinstein and it ended when he won the Oscar for Shakespeare in Love.
Right.
Like, or you did a, you know, Cosby movie and it's about his Jell-O commercials. Like, it's not good. I know it's probably really fun.
Let me ask you about something else then. What's your take on the Life of a Showgirl? Is that what it's called? The most recent Taylor Swift
film? I feel very, very medium about that. I don't know about you. I know you're Swiftie too.
Yeah.
It's like fine. It's just not my favorite. I was just thinking, I have been running, you know, is it like Opalite's on my running list? And I'm sorry to say, even Wood is on my running list. It is the correct tempo. I'm sorry. And like, I enjoy them. And like Opalite in particular, it's like one of those songs where you're like, you feel like they, like, just fell down from heaven. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. It's just so perfect that you're like, I can't believe this hasn't always been there.
That's right.
Almost like you can't judge it. It just
even
is.
Even the first time you heard it, it was like, oh yeah, this is Opalite.
Yeah, it just it feels like a memory. You're just like, oh yeah, this song.
The video,
like, it was
fantastic.
Okay, but it just didn't, like, there's other ones, like I'm a Midnight's Girl. That always sticks with, I feel like Midnight's was, like, written from my own soul. I think we all have our own ones like this from her. There's something, and I'm thrilled that she's happy, but maybe, whatever. I don't want to get into the, like, because she's happy, she's not as good at writing songs. That's not correct. But, like, you know, there might not be as much, like, grit and determination and anger. She's very fueled by anger a lot of the time.
That's right. So. Wish list is like the opposite of all of her.
That's true. Yeah. That's, I enjoy them all. They're just not like, it's the problem also with that, with her at this point, is there's so much that you're judging her against herself.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, like, and people ask you, like, in the Swiftie community, people will ask you, like, oh, what's your album or what's your three? And like that to me is telling, because it's more like each one expresses something. It's like about your own personality. So I'm like a Reputation lover, Midnight's Girl. But that's just because, like, for me, those songs hit the most at exactly that time.
It's like they're each an era. All right.
It's like they're each, you should do something about that. What did you think about the album?
I like it a lot. I enjoyed it. I think you know, the videos are also amazing. The Ophelia is just love it, and I love the acoustic versions. I like that she really puts effort into those acoustic versions.
Maybe I should listen more to the acoustic versions. It's very slick, you know. And I know that's not, I mean, that's always true of her stuff, but there's something extremely slick about this one.
When I listen to them with headphones, I'm like, the layering, so beautifully done. I mean, it's Beatles level of layering.
Yeah, I mean, and it's Max Martin. Like, it's, you know, like, there's, she wanted slick. She wanted, you know, she did everything she was going for. I also wonder if just like a little bit of oversaturation. I just need a minute.
Well, like, sure, because the album before, right, she put out 15
Tortured
songs.
Poets.
Yeah, she put out 15 songs, and then a day later, she put out 15 more songs. So
thank God she didn't do that. I loved that she had announced, like, don't worry, I'm not going to. She didn't say don't worry, but she kind of meant
that. Like, said that.
Like, this is it. Because, I mean, Tortured Poets was a little bit of homework. There's also
I don't think
ones
I've
on
ever
that.
Listened to all of it because there's too much.
No, you can't. You have to live your life.
Well, we've been chatting with Jennifer Cation Armstrong, and her new book is called Parks and Rec, the underdog TV show that literally inspired a vision for a better America. It's a wonderful book, and it's always so great to talk with you. Jennifer, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.